We're discussing big tech and whether our country needs to revise laws regulating social media after the violent insurrection at the Capitol. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Social media platforms can be a venue for hate speech, for bullying, and worse, dangerous groups use these platforms to misinform, to gin up conspiracy theories, and to plan attacks like the deadly one on our Capitol. Have you seen talk of violence online? Have you ever tried to report it, to stop it? What laws would you support governing speech online? 800-642-1234 to join in. Shannon McGregor is an assistant professor at the Hussman School of Journalism and Media and a senior researcher with the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Shannon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, and good morning.
Good morning. The events of January 6th, it brought a ton of traffic and attention to parts of the internet that aren't top of mind when we think social media, like Parler and Gab, but it wasn't just fringe sites. It was the high-profile ones, too. Can you explain for us what planning was done on social media and the role it had on the January 6th attack?
Yeah, social media was really integral in the organization of this event that then turned into an attack. And as you said, some of it happened on, you know, smaller or more fringe sites, but lots of it happened out in the open on sites that lots of people are on, like Twitter, and even more so on Facebook. There was a report yesterday that came out that showed how many Facebook groups, you know, people were being pushed to these political Facebook groups that, you know, even though they took down Stop the Steal, had, you know, Win the Win in them and were really used for planning this event on January 6th.
Do you think that the niche platforms that have provided safe haven for extremist movements, will they be coming under increased scrutiny from now on? And if so, by whom?
I do think that we might see this, you know, one of the things that there is bipartisan agreement on, which there's not many, but one of them is that the tech companies need some type of regulation. I think, you know, the Republican and Democratic parties have really different ideas about what that might look like and how it might come about. But I do think with the incoming Biden administration, we're likely to see some type of regulation. You know, what that exactly looks like, I think it's going to be hard to tell, but it's clear that we need some type of regulation around speech that incites violence, that does run rampant on some of these platforms.
Silicon Valley's power, as you're saying, has become a concern of Congress. You see it in the antitrust lawsuits filed by dozens of state attorneys general and the Justice Department. There is this power struggle going on, and social media platforms, they wield power. How do you see this playing out in government regulation and policy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that it comes down to the decision of one person, Jack Dorsey, you know, running Twitter to take the president basically offline. Whether or not you agree with that decision, I think everyone agrees that that sets a dangerous precedent. And so the type of regulation that we might see is around, you know, what sort of protections are in place for political figures on these sites? You know, do they need to be broken up so that one decision doesn't affect someone across three or four of these platforms, like we might see in the case with Facebook, which also owns Instagram and which also owns WhatsApp, which when you combine those three represents billions of people on these platforms and millions within the US. And so there might be some type of regulation in the protections that these tech platforms have right now. And there also might be some type of regulation in terms of what sort of speech is prioritized on these platforms. But as of right now, they're private platforms and they can, you know, make decisions about the type of speech that they would like to host and the type of speech that they would not like to host, which is what we've seen really, I think, around the 2020 election.
You know, the researchers and the academics who, like you, closely monitor and parse the rhetoric on these sites have said that the exchanges on these platforms have always been extreme. The language is always intense, but this overheated rhetoric doesn't necessarily translate to outright violence. And then that all changed on January 6th. Were you surprised?
I don't think anyone was surprised by this. It was shocking, but not surprising, as I think the sort of view that I've settled on. You know, for years, basically, leading up to 2020. So in the wake of 2016 and sort of the, you know, revelations of fake news and Russian interference, Facebook made a decision to deprioritize news and prioritize groups. They thought this would connect people with more regular people, and that's what people wanted on Facebook. But what we saw was while some of these groups were for cancer survivors or for people who like knitting or cooking, some of them were really about extreme views. We saw QAnon flourish on there, for example. And what we know across many social media platforms is that what gets engagement is more extreme posts. And then once something gets engagement, then it gets more engagement. And so it really does help encourage an extremity of views.
We're talking with Shannon McGregor, an expert in social media and its effects on politics, discussing how the violent insurrection was planned online and where we go from here. You can join in. Have you seen talk of violence online? How have you tried to quell it? Have you reported it? Do you have a family member or friend who believes in conspiracy theories online? What do you say? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Marcus is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What would you like to add?
Good morning. So I feel like we need to go to the Bible for this, and it says nothing's new under the sun. We've always had this type of smearing in type of negative rhetoric that's out there. I mean, going back to the Federalist Papers with our founding fathers, bringing it forward, you know, I think it's a slippery slope if we start regulating this. However, on the other side, I feel like it's a tech company, and if, you know, albeit a very large tech company or whatever, if they want to take and pull the platform for people's, you know, rhetoric or whatever they want to talk about, I think that's fully within their rights because, you know, they're not obligated to broadcast speech that is against what they believe. And so, while yes, I'm not necessarily for, you know, like having tech companies decide because they do control media to how much of the world, you know, but it's like, I also do feel like it's their right, just like if, you know, you guys aren't required to broadcast hate speech, you know?
Marcus, thank you for that. You know, Marcus brings up deplatforming and, you know, that this is a slippery slope, Shannon.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Marcus makes a great point. These are private companies and they are allowed to make whatever decisions they would like about the speech that's on their platform. You know, they do not need to host hate speech. What I think is concerning is, you know, as you know, we already have such a fractured media environment and indeed a fractured social environment. And what, you know, one of the worries about deplatforming of some of these more extreme views is good, but does it drive people to a place where they're even less likely to engage with people who have different views with them or even with reality, you know, and does that further deepen sort of the divides that we see in this country?
Yeah, I wonder, do you think there will always be a way for extremist voices, whether it is QAnon, whether it is white supremacists or Proud Boys or whomever, to keep communicating, to making their views known and finding each other on the internet?
I mean, yes, absolutely. And, you know, although, of course, I think social media is important, that's why I research it. I just want to point out this is not a social media problem, right? This is the problem. We see white supremacist views broadcast on cable news networks. You know, we see them coming out of some of the highest, you know, offices in this nation. And so while social media has certainly played a role in exacerbating these views, potentially in spreading them to more people, this is a society-wide problem. You know, one of my colleagues said yesterday in panel, and I think it's the right idea. If we don't agree with these views, and if we want them to not be a part of our society, if we want to say white supremacy is wrong, then people with these views need to be sort of widely shunned, right? And that's on social media, but it's sort of more broadly. It's not just a social media problem.
Yeah, you have to broaden out and look holistically at the problem. Let's go to Steve now in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi, what would you like to bring here?
Yeah, I get a little angry about some of this conversation. There's hateful rhetoric across the board. We saw months upon months upon months of hateful rhetoric coming from so-called Black Lives Matter people online in the news with lies upon lies upon lies. We've had seizures of cities. We've had buildings burnt down. We've had intimidation, which is domestic violence. And yet the only thing we talk about is a minority of people that are white supremacists. Even last night on NPR, they had an extremist Black Lives Matter group, I believe it was called the People's Movement. And yet we don't talk about that. And we just talk about this minority of groups that is universally condemned by all. When are we
let's Shannon jump in here with her thoughts. Go ahead, Shannon.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to realize that there are extreme views on both sides, but they don't have the same consequences. Only people who supported one political party stormed the Capitol and tried to interfere in our democratic process. You know, and I think what's most important to uphold, whether you're from the right or you're from the left, is the idea that we're in a democracy and that everyone's votes count and everyone's voices should be heard as long as they are upholding democratic principles. And I think that's what has to undergird our discussion around what sort of speech and what sort of political actions we support is whether it's democratic or not.
Let's bring in Michael now in Bear Valley. Michael, hi.
Hello. I just have a question about media literacy. I think one of the problems I see is that a lot of these extremist groups are thriving on lies and misinformation. And I'm wondering why media literacy isn't a part of the standard curriculum, especially in high school. Madison has a very illustrative history in media literacy projects. And I was just wondering why some of these projects aren't integrated into the curriculums in high school.
Michael, thank you. Shannon, media literacy, are we behind?
Media literacy should definitely be an important part of it. You know, I have a 9-year-old, and since he's been in first grade, they've been talking, you know, in his classes around how to judge information, you know, that they find on the internet and things like that. I do think media literacy is an important part of it, but it's not going to solve everything. You know, all the correct information in the world could not have stopped what happened on January 6th. Disinformation and misinformation is a tool that exacerbates extreme ideas, that deepens the divisions that already exist in our country. So I think any type of media literacy has to be, on the one hand, about, you know, the judging the veracity of information, and that's an important part of it. But another part of media literacy is understanding the sort of deep divisions and white supremacist history of this country so that you can judge information with that sort of critical eye from both perspectives.
Shannon McGregor, an assistant professor and senior researcher at the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We're discussing how to regulate social media. Where do we go from here? How should the government address the power of big tech? Does a shift to more insular spaces like Telegram and Gab raise the risk of conspiracy theories and radicalization? How do you want local law enforcement to track down or break up the plotting of violence online? 800-642-1234 to join in. Back in a minute with Shannon McGregor here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the role of social media in the violent insurrection on the Capitol and how to govern speech online. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The plans to storm the Capitol unfolded on sites like Facebook, on Twitter, on fringe social media sites long before the attack happened. Critics say social media companies, to a certain extent, permitted talk of the violence to persist without cracking down enough and bear some responsibility. Should platforms be held legally responsible for the riot? Should tech companies share some of the blame? Join in 800-642-1234. Shannon McGregor is with the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. We heard from Kathy in Milwaukee, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Kathy wants to know, Shannon, if the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, could crack down more on networks for spreading false information online. Kathy asks, what is the role of the FCC?
The role of the FCC depends on whether we consider platforms to be media or not, you know, and they have long resisted this idea that they play any role, that they are media platforms, and that they make editorial decisions. I think one of the silver linings of all of this around 2020 and around the six as well is that it is so clear now that these platforms are media companies, that they are making editorial decisions about, you know, things that really do impact our public sphere and impact our politics. And so that then makes it more likely that some of these regulatory bodies can come in and play a role. This would not be new. It would probably have to be around paid speech in the way that political advertisements are regulated through TV, for example. But there is a role to play if we can agree that these platforms are indeed media companies that make editorial decisions.
So when Twitter erases tens of thousands of accounts affiliated with QAnon following the Capitol breach, this is reactive. This is a reactive approach. You know, banning you on Twitter after years of abusive and hateful language, that's after it's happened. Is the current approach to combating disinformation or extremism, is this working in a reactive way?
It's absolutely reactive. And I think that's one of the things that's been most frustrating as a researcher to watch, and as I'm sure it's been frustrating for just many regular people to watch, right? Because it's no surprise, right? As I said, the events on 1/6 were shocking, but absolutely not surprising. You know, in the extremity of some of the views are not surprising. And we only see these companies acting in these really reactive ways once the harm is already done. If instead they had principles that undergirded these policies that were around supporting democracy, we might see them be more proactive and not necessarily having the speech flourish and cause harm before it's taken down. And I hope that's what we see going forward.
Shannon McGregor researches social media, how it impacts political processes. We're understanding social media's role in the Capitol insurrection and how tech companies are responding. With your questions and insights, 800-642-1234 to join in the conversation. Let's bring in Brady now in Madison. Hi, Brady. What would you like to say?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call and creating such a wonderful conversation today. I just wanted to broach a question through a comment. I'm a member of the liquor industry, and so we have a three supplier tiered system that really protects consumers and it aids the government in enforcing regulation. And as the whole liquor industry, liquor stores, distributors, and liquor suppliers, we're regulated by ourselves by an industry called DISCUS, and it's a board of our own lawyers that keep us accountable to our own marketing practices and sales practices. And so they keep us from doing things like advertising to kids intentionally or paying off accounts or price control on the shelf. And the reason that we regulate ourselves is because the United States government isn't prepared resources to stay modern on technology, keep up with us. And so they monitor us monitoring ourselves in order to allow us to be effective and stay nimble as an industry. And I was wondering if you, as such an expert, and thank you for sharing your time with us today and helping us with this conundrum, if you thought maybe that could be a system that might be viable or might be beneficial. I'll take my comments off air.
Yeah, thank
you. So much. I hope everyone's feeling.
Yeah, thank you, Brady. Shannon, go ahead. You know, just having a board of your own lawyers keeping this industry accountable.
I mean, I think it's a middle ground, right? That might be part of the solution to the issue, you know, and it was interesting. Thanks, Brady, for sort of talking about that. I didn't know that that's how it was sort of regulated. Obviously, it's outside my area of expertise. But I think, you know, in general, self-regulation in our country, at least, has never worked all the way. But it certainly is part of the solution, right? One of the problems, though, is, and as I think you all pointed out at the sort of lead to the show, is that there's so few companies at the center of this, right? And so they still wield so much power, and how that might be distributed in this sort of, industry-wide, it's not as many organizations coming into the industry. We see Facebook, Google, and Twitter, to a lesser extent, playing such a huge role in this that I would worry about the power inequities there in terms of governing it with a democratic end.
So we saw the social media company Parler taken offline following the breach and then slowly creeping back online. The decision had been made by Amazon, Google, and Apple to take it offline. But you know, now it is partially back. How is this happening?
From the reporting I've read, it is supported by companies based in Russia and not the Amazon Web Services that there used to be. And so that's probably worrying from a national security perspective, although that's not my own area of expertise. But, you know, I think what Parler points to is really this idea, and we've seen this on other sites as well, that when there is very little moderation and very little policy around what type of speech is not only allowed but encouraged, that views tend to get incredibly extreme quite quickly. You know, there's this sort of snowball to extremity on sites that don't have any moderation policies. And frankly, I don't think that's what most people want when they're logging on to a social media site, right? They're not looking for violent rhetoric. But as we saw on January 6th, it doesn't take, you know, it doesn't have to be everyone, right? It can be one very extreme group taking action that have these devastating consequences for people's lives.
So is there a threat then for these platforms to find internet companies to host them who are, for lack of a better word, sympathetic to their cause, to their views?
Yeah, there is, right? Because, you know, this is why we saw Amazon and similarly, we saw, you know, the Google App Store and the Apple App Store take Parler down, because they decided not only did they not want to be potentially legally liable, but they didn't want to support this extreme speech and they didn't want to be a haven for violent and hateful rhetoric. And so if you're saying that you do support Parler and you're putting it back online, then you're basically saying we support violent rhetoric and we're okay with that being a consequence of having little or no moderation. And I think that's really worrisome. Again, when we think about it from a democratic standpoint, disagreement, fine. Inciting violence, not fine.
So let me ask you this, since Trump has been taken out of Twitter and other realms of social media, have we seen yet a decline in disinformation and misinformation?
You know, there's been one study that has said that they have seen a decline in misinformation because of that, but the methods on that were not quite clear. So, I'll wait for more research to support that claim. But what I think we have seen is less misinformation coming from the president, right? Twitter was his pipeline to the news and thus to many more millions of people than follow him on Twitter or even on Twitter. And what we know is that speech that comes from people who are powerful, and, you know, in our country, almost no one is more powerful than the president, has such a greater impact than a tweet that I might send or you might send. And so in deplatforming, you know, one of the most powerful people in our country who was spreading disinformation, we can certainly see that alone making a huge impact in the extent to which people are exposed to this type of dangerous mis and disinformation.
Okay, we only have, you know, 30 seconds or so left. As you look at President-elect, soon to be President Joe Biden, what do you expect to see from his social media presence and what this administration will do with online platforms?
I certainly expect incoming President Biden's Twitter account to be not quite as exciting as our outgoing president's, right? But, you know, like Twitter was a pipeline for Trump to get in the news, you know, we have no reason to suspect that an incoming President Biden won't use Twitter as sort of a press release in the same way. It's a place where politicians can get their views and their words out relatively unencumbered. You know, it's not a press conference where journalists are asking questions. It's not an interview where a journalist is pushing back. It's a place where you can get your speech out there that's not going to be questioned directly. And that's a great power that a president or any other politician can wield. And they prefer that, of course. So I think there's no reason to suspect that the Biden camp won't use that in the same way. I don't think we're likely to see the sort of excitement, though, that leads journalists to cover it quite so breathlessly.
Shannon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Shannon McGregor is an assistant professor at the Hussman School of Journalism and Media at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Ahead this hour, we look at vaccination rates across the country and see how Wisconsin compares. We'll talk more after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.